We're going to take a trip now into the largest private real estate development in the history of this country. It's in, where else? New York City, on the west side of Manhattan, next to the Hudson River. Its first phase includes six skyscrapers, many of which are currently under construction. They range from 780 to 1,296 feet in height. For comparison, the tip top of the Empire State Building is 1,454 feet off the ground. Construction on five of these six new towers will be finished next year and only just started 6 years ago.
Well, I think the dream is to create a new urban environment, the likes of which we haven't really seen before. That's responsive to the 21st century, you know, capitalizes on the desire for people to live in cities and sort of raise the bar for what a city can mean for everyone. I mean, we now have over half the world's population living in cities for the first time ever. It's a pretty important shift.
That's Jay Cross, the president of the Hudson Yards project, which is being undertaken by Related Companies, a real estate firm. We met with him on the 24th floor of 10 Hudson Yards, the first skyscraper to be completed. It's already home to Coach, Kate Spade, L'Oreal USA, SAP, and a host of fashion, technology, and media companies. Cross says the urban shift that's happening in America means today's skyscrapers need to be very different than those built nearly a century ago.
That means creating a, we often say, live, work, play environment, but I think more importantly, it's creating a mixed-use environment that's vibrant 24 hours a day, that is diverse in lots of different ways, and has something to offer everybody. So everybody wants to be there for some reason.
When you say mixed use, how much of this is going to be residential? How much of it is going to be commercial or other things?
So it's about 20 million square feet when we're all said and done. And of that, probably 80-plus percent is 50-50 between office and residential. But we don't build it that way. We tend towards office in the beginning, and then we tend towards residential in the back half because we want to create a sense of place quickly. We got to get critical mass and density quickly. And so by building four office towers and a million square feet of retail, you know, we're able to create a destination right off the bat. While we would say retail, residential, and commercial are the three essential components of a mixed-use community, what's really important is that you've got to intensify those uses, and you intensify them with all the little things that you do in between those uses. So the public
like
space,
what?
The public space, the gardens, the shed, the vessel, the observation deck, mass transit.
Let's explain a couple of those. The vessel is a giant $200 million sculpture comprised of 154 interconnecting flights of stairs. The shed is a $600 million arts center with an outer shell that can expand and contract. There will also be restaurants, gyms, and a hotel.
All these things create a sense of community that touches every aspect of live, work, and play.
Can you do that right away? I mean, you're saying that you want that to start very quickly, that this feels right. There's a sense of place here.
Yeah, we think we're on track to do that. We'll open by next March. So come the spring of 19, the first half will be open. It'll create a destination the likes of which New Yorkers have never seen. And I think part of the issue for us is that until they see it, you can't really imagine it.
How do you make sure that people are actually living in these buildings and that it's not investors, maybe foreign investors, who buy them but then don't live here and then don't help you create that sense of place?
Well, it's very difficult to sort of legislate that you have
right.
to live there. I think it depends on the nature of the resident. So if you're a young millennial worker, you're going to be living there because you're going to be paying a lot of your paycheck out in rent. If, on the other hand, you're a retired couple and you're empty nesters and you want to keep the family home in Westchester, or you've got a retirement space in Florida for the winter, you're going to be there a good portion of the time, but you're not going to be there 100% of the time. That's what New York City is. I mean, New York City has a lot of people that live here. Obviously, 8 million people do.
Right.
But there's an awful lot of people that own residences here that have multiple residences in different cities.
I imagine, though, that a lot of New Yorkers, as they watch these beautiful glass towers go up, they wonder, will I ever be able to afford to live in a place like that?
Well, we certainly hope they can. I mean, just behind us here, we have two rental buildings, close to 600 units. And we've opened in the last 2 years and they're 100% leased. And we'll be building affordable accommodation as well at Hudson Yards. And we'll be building condos too. So I think the whole concept is that there's something for everybody. Because of the cost of living in New York City, we're conscious of new segments of the residential market, super small units, the seniors community, We're finding that seniors, for instance, still want to stay in the city because the city allows them to stay vibrant. They like to walk out onto the street and see what's happening. So that perhaps suggests a different model for seniors living in an urban environment.
When I look at this, you know, series of glass tall buildings, and you hear about the celebrity chefs that will be locating their restaurants in here, it sounds a little like Las Vegas. What do you think about that?
Well, first of all, the buildings are all tall, that's true, but they're not all glass. So we have stone all over the place.
Okay.
And we're very mindful of not trying to create a skyline of all tall glass buildings. But to answer your further question on the restaurants, food and beverage is a huge important element of any urban environment, and it's particularly true in New York, where people dine out a lot. And so having lots of restaurant options, which includes celebrity chefs, but also includes Shake Shack and Sweetgreen's, which you passed on the way in here today, and Momofuku, and we've got probably five different coffee shops. I mean, we're trying to be very mindful of what the public want and more or less demand today in terms of a full dining experience. And that dining experience is important because it goes to late at night. It starts early in the morning, it goes to late at night. And that also is an important attribute.
Keep a lot of people.
You got to keep a lot of people. The new worker. So a big part of what we've done today is build what we call the workplace of the future, because we're mindful of the workforce of the future. And that workforce of the future want to do everything in one place. If they can live here, they would. If they can't, they're going to spend as much time here as they can. And that means it's their leisure time and their eating time and their dining time. And so we ask all our retailers to stay open till 10 at night, because you want that constant dynamic neighborhood feel.
Jay Cross takes us on a tour of some of the unfinished parts of Hudson Yards. The ground floor of one tower has that new building smell. The marble floors are protected with plywood. There's caution tape blocking the many new and unused escalators. And the ceilings are many stories above us.
So this is just a big racetrack. So there's retail in the middle and there's retail all around the outside.
This is going to be basically a mall in here.
We don't like to use that word.
Why not?
Because a mall is generally one level. You know, it's a horizontal suburban exercise. We're seven levels. And seven levels in America is very unusual. Seven levels in Asia is not uncommon at all. So,
But this is going to be all retail right here where we're walking.
It's all retail. Everything we're walking through is retail. We're going to come out on the corner of 33rd and 10th, and then we're going to walk along to 30 Hudson Yards, which is all office.
The buildings have been designed to group together various industries. One tower, for example, was built for law firms. Another was made for hedge funds and investment companies.
Here we're down in the hole. We're building our way up. This is the building that BlackRock will occupy. And then 55, you can see ahead of you, the lawyer's building. That building will actually open before the end of this year.
This may sound like any construction site. But remember, we're just blocks from the busiest train station in America. New York City is buzzing all around us. The city has just expanded one of its subway lines to bring people to Hudson Yards with a new station that just opened in 2015 right underneath the site.
This street is 33rd Street. We had to completely rebuild the street on behalf of the city.
Wow.
So it used to go down and then come up, and so we leveled it all off, rebuilt the street, relay the utilities. And then underneath here, we have a tunnel connection that goes from 30 Hudson Yards to 50 Hudson Yards. There'll be another tunnel connection from 50 Hudson Yards under Hudson Boulevard into the number 7 subway. And that's why I was able to make the statement. You'll be able to get on a train in Stamford and come here and never go outside.
This is probably the first time in a long time that 33rd Street has been a dirt road.
Yeah, that's true. But it was once upon a time.
It was.
Once upon a time, this spot was a wasteland compared to much of the rest of Manhattan. I asked Jay Cross if the city's public transit system, even with a new station, will be able to handle all of the people who will live and work in this new development.
I mean, I think it's all a question of scale. So 600,000 people a day go into Penn Station. Mm-hmm. We have 40,000 office workers. Only about 10,000, maybe 15,000 of those office workers come in through Penn Station. So are we really going to move the needle on Penn Station? I don't think so. Is Long Island Railroad and New Jersey Transit going to increase capacity? Absolutely. They have to. That's the goal for the region.
You're also right next to the Hudson River. Have you thought about that in your plans, maybe of you know, in the future, rising waters? Is that making you do anything differently?
Well, we did a few things differently as a result of Sandy. So the rail yards did flood during Superstorm Sandy. But the rail yards are only 7 feet above sea level. So, yeah, we had certainly plus 7 foot rise. But our ground floor, because we have to build over the trains, is more like 40 feet above sea level. And so that's above the 500-year flood. So the idea that we would ever have water in our ground floors is pretty remote. But we do have elevator pits that go down close to the trains, and we have oil tanks down there. People would say, well, if the, you know, if the elevator pit floods, it'll just knock out the control system. It, you know, it won't be that bad. And so that's still unacceptable. I can't have the elevator control system knocked out. So we actually submarined all of the elevator pits so that if the water comes up around the pit, it's not in the pit, and therefore all the control systems are still up and running. And so we made a number of changes like that.
The promise of Hudson Yards sounds a lot like the promise of another real estate development that used to be just a few miles to the south.
The purpose of the World Trade Center is to increase the flow of international trade. It brings together 130,000 people each day, people of business and government involved in processing international commerce. The towers are occupied by the communications, financing, transportation, and education facilities required to carry on business more efficiently.
When it opened in downtown Manhattan in the 1970s, the original World Trade Center held a lot of promise as a city within a city. I asked Jay Cross about that.
I was recently down at the 9/11 Museum, and they have an exhibit there where they have an old sign that was out in front of the World Trade Center when it was up, when the Twin Towers were there, that was describing what a marvel it was and how many people were going to work there and how many, you know, offices there would be. And as I was looking at that and thinking about this project, it was a similar dream that they had down there.
Sure. I mean, not only was it a similar dream, I think in its day it achieved similar results. So I think that what was achieved at the original World Trade Center, and I think that was a great example of a city reinventing itself and providing a brand new neighborhood. And we can look back at it today and say we might have done things differently from an urban planning point of view, but in terms of raw ambition and demand, it was a great example of what we've done here. So the really good examples are Rockefeller Center, of course, World Trade Center and Battery Park, Hudson Yards, Canary Wharf, Roppongi Hills in Tokyo. There's a few. There are not a lot of them.
Are you worried about being a target the way that the World Trade Center was?
I think any large development today has to be concerned about that. I'm not even sure if you're a large development yet to be. I think, you know, what we've seen in Paris and London doesn't necessarily mean you have to be a high-profile target. So we devote a lot of time and energy to security. We want people to feel inherently safe, but we don't want people to feel like they're in an armed camp.
When we think of the construction of skyscrapers, one of the images that comes to mind is those guys sitting on a suspension beam, right, you know, eating their lunch.
Yeah.
How different is it to build one today than it was almost 100 years ago?
Remarkably, it's not that much different. I mean, you would like to think that with the advent of technology, we would be building differently today. But we really don't. We have tower cranes, and you know, it's a race to get to the top of the structure, and then you've got to get the first elevator running, and the glass wall systems have been around since the 60s, all slightly refined, but basically built with the same trades, same labor component.
I imagine the safety standards have changed.
Safety's
over the
changed
years.
A lot. And so I was going to say the one thing that has changed is that the safety is dramatically improved. I mean, knock on wood, we have never had a really serious accident on this job yet. And we've employed 20,000 workers to date. It's a pretty extraordinary safety record that we hope to take all the way through.
We're actually sitting in one of the new buildings right now, right, on the 20-something floor.
24th floor of 10 Hudson Yards.
Of 10 Hudson Yards. How many people right now are working all around us on building the rest of this complex?
So any given day, there's roughly 4,000 workers on site. This building we're sitting in houses 7,000 office workers.
Already.
So they come to work every day here.
Dressed in suits, not construction.
Well, not very many in suits. So let me tell you about the office worker here. So this is a brand new Class A building, and 70% of the 7,000 workers are under the age of 45, and 50% of them are millennials. And there are only 7% that are old gray-haired baby boomers like me in this building. It's an extraordinary workforce.
You're proud of that, it sounds like, that there are so many young people working in this building.
Yeah, we think that this has really become real evidence of what we set out to do, which was to build the new workplace for the future, like to build new modern buildings that emphasize collaboration, emphasize light, de-emphasize authority, and so really making the space responsive to a young worker has been our goal. So we've got 7,000 workers here today, and by the time we finish next summer, we'll have 40,000 workers a day here. That's going to be an amazing place.
A project of this size has its critics. Some are unimpressed with the design of the skyscrapers themselves. Others question whether you can recreate the vibrant, organic nature of New York in a planned development. And there are many who worry about what all these fancy new buildings will do to the already sky-high cost of housing. I asked Jay Cross what the biggest challenge of this project has been.
Well, it's hard to say. What the challenges, you know, vary over time. So in the beginning, it was convincing people that we could pull it off, we could make it happen, and get our first, you know, commercial tenants. So Coach, SAP, L'Oreal were all pioneers in the early days. But then once we got momentum going, the momentum started to build very quickly. And I think one of the new challenges then became, like, how do we find all the capital? It's $16 billion being deployed out there right now. And nobody had ever raised that kind of money in that short a time frame in one place.
How did you find all that capital?
Well, we had to go around the world, basically, and lift up every flat rock and every capital source there was. Because in a post-recession world, the American banks had limits on how much they can invest in one company, how much they can invest in one project, how much they can invest in one geography. And so it meant that these big buildings, which require, in general, billion-dollar loans, had to be sliced up into $75 million pieces. That's a lot of banks. So that was a challenge for a while. I would say the last challenge is now today we're leasing a lot of space, we're selling a lot of units, and, you know, we're marketing as hard and as fast as we can.
And we're about 10 years into an economic recovery. Are you worried that all of a sudden something terrible will happen in the economy and it could put some of the development that is yet to come at risk?
Well, I think one's always worried that the economy is going to have ebbs and flows. But I think that when you take on a project like this, you have to build into the fact that over 20 years, you're going to hit one or two recessions. And so I don't think we went into it, you know, Pollyannish in that respect. And I think we've been lucky that we actually started in the recession. We were able to get good construction pricing because everybody was hungry for work. All that's changed in the last few years. So that momentum we've been aided by. It's been a wind at our back. But I think the other side of the coin is, unlike some of the big, big projects in the past, like Canary Wharf, we're extremely conservatively financed. So we're probably only 50% debt, 50% equity. We've insulated ourselves. We're not industry specific. We have the leaders of media, the leaders of fashion, the leaders of tech, the leaders of private equity, the leaders of hedge funds, the leaders of banks. I mean, we're in every major industry type in New York, and I think we've got a lot of built-in resiliency there.
Okay, it's going to be plenty noisy for the next 5 minutes. It'll take us 5 minutes to get to the top.
5 minutes to get to the top.
Close enough.
We board a metal cage elevator on the side of the tallest of the new skyscrapers, a 1,296-foot tower that will open next year. It's made of glass, and near the top, there's a platform that shoots off the side of the building. When it opens, it'll be the highest outdoor observation deck in the Western Hemisphere. As we step out onto a cement floor...
Oh, wow.
We can see all of Manhattan. There's a hole in the floor up ahead, and that is by design.
That'll be glass. You'll be able to walk on that and look straight down.
So who in their right mind would want to do that?
Some people.
Just look down through the glass.
Yeah.
How many stories down?
100, 1,000 feet.
Wow.
Also in view, the new World Trade Center down at the southern tip of Manhattan. Cross took me up a set of large metal steps.
You're on the edge of the world.
This is like the modern-day image of that picture of the guy sitting there having lunch on the
correct.
Top of the beam.
Exactly right.
Unbelievable. And this view, I mean, this is the first time I've ever seen it. Do you still get amazed by this?
Oh, yeah. The view, you can never get tired of the view. It's just so exceptional. There's the Statue of Liberty. There's downtown. You can see the Verrazano Bridge. You can see the ships coming and going. You get a sense of the traffic in the bay. You get East River, Madison Square. You know, that's Midtown. It feels like a model that you can reach out and touch.
I feel like a little kid playing with your blocks or something.
Yeah, exactly right. You, this is very much for the kid in all of us. It's really like a playground in the sky.
This playground in the sky is expensive. The total cost of construction for Hudson Yards is $25 billion. That's three times the estimates for the new World Trade Center buildings and three times the cost of the City Center project on the Las Vegas Strip. 30 Hudson Yards is just one of many skyscrapers currently going up across the U.S. The 1,186-foot Vista Tower in Chicago, the 579-foot Capitol Tower in Houston, and the 1,100-foot Wilshire Grand, which just became the tallest building in Los Angeles. Jason Barr is a professor of economics at Rutgers University and the author of Building the Skyline. He says the Hudson Yards project tells us something about America in 2018.
In many respects, it represents the ability to cater to work in the 21st century. Much of the growth in the American economy is taking place in older urban centers like New York. So to the extent that a place like New York can continue to grow and continue to accommodate the kind of growth that's important to the 21st century, then I think that's important to the United States as a whole.
The question now is whether all the promises being made will be kept, that Hudson Yards will actually become a vibrant new neighborhood overnight, that it'll have a positive effect for people who aren't wealthy, and that it'll eventually survive its first recession.